This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for joining us. And this hour, a theme, you might say, nations torn apart, literally, in the case of Rwanda, looking back 20 years this week to the genocide that killed a million people. Also, we'll talk about the divisive politics in India and Afghanistan as both nations go to the polls. But we begin with a nation that some believe is tearing itself apart right now.
The reason I talked about two Americas is because I believe we have a country made up of a few people who are doing extremely well and then everybody else. As you go down the line, there are two kinds of Americas.
Goodness gracious, are you still talking about the two Americas? Yeah, I'm still talking about the two Americas because they are still out there.
The two America idea that politician and presidential candidate John Edwards started to run on more than a decade ago has, if anything, gotten worse in that time. In his upsetting new book, journalist Matt Taibbi says that from his perspective, America is headed towards a brink where justice looks more like injustice and the state chooses defendants according to who is the least powerful, not who has committed the worst crimes. Here's an example.
Today, we are announcing the indictment, or guilty pleas, of 19 individuals on charges including mortgage fraud, securities fraud, and conspiracy, as well as the indictment of Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a federally chartered bank that has been catering to the Chinese immigrant community since 1984.
That announcement from the New York District Attorney in 2012 to prosecute the Abacus Savings Bank for crimes in the mortgage fraud aftermath of the financial meltdown. It's a symbol, says Taibbi, of how misguided the American justice system has become. Taibbi's new book is called The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So you hear a politician, a John Edwards, talk about two Americas. It kind of burns you up a little bit.
Yeah, I just think that term is sort of emotionally insufficient to describe what's going on. I think when people hear that term, what they mostly conjure up is a statistic about income inequality. They think that some people are making enormous sums of money and other people aren't making as much money. And I think the reaction among a large segment of the population is, so what? That's the way America is supposed to be. This is a land of opportunity and no one here wants a handout. And if some people make it rich, well, that's a good thing. And if other people are on the bottom strata, well, that's their fault. But I think it's a much more pervasive and serious problem than that. I think there are baked into the infrastructure of our society sort of unfairnesses that make it impossible for some people to rise up.
And there are many scenes in here that describe that, and we'll talk about them in a moment. But in general, you say beyond two Americas, the new truth is a sci-fi movie, a dystopia. In this sci-fi world, the issues aren't justice and injustice, but biology and mortality. We have a giant meat-grinding bureaucracy that literally alters the physical makeup of its citizens, systematically grinding down the losers into a smaller, meeker, lower race of animal while aggrandizing the winners, making them bigger than life, impervious, super people. It's Trump versus the poor, and the poor aren't winning.
Right, yeah. And I mean, again, what I really focus on in this book is the criminal justice system, and this is where you can see the disparity the most easily. We have a situation now, especially after the crash, especially after cases like HSBC and UBS, where essentially if you commit a certain kind of crime, a certain kind of fraud, and you work at a big enough, systemically important enough company, you are effectively immune from prosecution. The state has more or less announced that it will not seek criminal remedies against you as an individual.
And part of that story comes from Eric Holder, our current attorney general, who wrote a memo a long time ago saying that you have to really consider what the impact is on the world for a bank to go down or an insurance company or an Arthur Andersen to go down. And that suddenly allows companies to protect themselves in ways they weren't able to do a generation ago.
That's right. And there are a lot of things about that policy that actually are sensible when you think about it. I mean, do you really want Arthur Andersen, you know, this venerable company that has existed forever and employs 27,000 people? Do you want it to be removed from the face of the earth because they made, well, let's say a considerable error in their dealings with Enron? But should that be the end? Should all those people lose their jobs? Maybe not. But the problem is that you can't extend that policy to include individuals. If you're going to decide not to indict companies, you at the very least have to find a way to make the individuals who do wrong things suffer in some way. And that's what they haven't done.
And the poor person on welfare certainly doesn't have the defense, hey, if you search my apartment and deny my welfare, you know, I might lose my job, or my son might lose his job, or there might be impacts in the community.
Might lose her Section 8 housing, or I will never get welfare again. But if you go in and you indict a single mom on welfare for welfare fraud, the consequences in her life and in the lives of her family members are incalculable. They will follow those people around forever. And we've decided that those consequences are acceptable, that we can live with those because that's a small enough those people are small enough in the scale of things, whereas we can't tolerate it when it's a really, really big company.
Can you share with us some of what you describe as the meat grinding degradation of these searches of people who are the poorest of the poor, having to justify what's in their clothes drawers as a way of showing that they aren't committing fraud?
Yeah, I found this one program in San Diego. They call it the P100 program, that essentially the state is allowed to preemptively search your home. If you're applying for welfare, the premise is that, let's say you've applied for welfare and you're a single mother and you're saying you have no other source of income. Well, then they will send someone to your apartment, not a social worker, but somebody who might actually work for the district attorney's office, to go into your home, and they will look for evidence that a man is living there, for instance, and they'll go through your underwear drawer to see if you have. In some cases, I talked to some women who talked about how the searcher would go through her underwear drawer with a pencil end and pick out the sexy panties and say, who do you need these for? Or they would go into the bathroom and say, why do you have two toothbrushes? Is there somebody else living here? And this is incredibly humiliating. And the reality is almost everybody in some way or another is dependent upon the state. What about everybody who takes a tax deduction? What about farmers who take subsidies? Are they going to be subject to these kinds of searches? They haven't decided that, but they have definitely decided that a certain kind of person on welfare has fewer rights than the rest of us.
We alluded to this in the introduction, but your book opens with an aggressive prosecutor going after a bank, finally going to snail some bankers with criminal charges. But the reveal, when you step back and figure out what bank we're talking about, and we just referred to District Attorney Cy Vance trying to indict the Abacus Savings Bank, we realize this bank is much less than meets the eye and certainly no Goldman Sachs. What does that story say to you?
Well, that was an incredible story to me. First of all, visually, it was so striking because here's the first indictment of a bank for almost 20 years. I think actually it was beyond 20 years at that point. The case is taking place downtown. If you look out the window, you can actually see the skyscrapers belonging to all the biggest malefactors in the financial crisis. And I'm not going to name them here, but you know who they are, all the big, too big to fail banks. You can see their huge gleaming skyscrapers. And they've all of these companies have been inveigled in, you know, scandals involving subprime mortgage fraud.
And have paid billions in settlements, civil settlements.
Billions in civil settlements. So it's been established that there was all sorts of wrongdoing that went on in these companies. Are any of those banks on trial? No. It turns out that instead of looking southward from that courtroom, we're looking northward to Chinatown, to this little bank that's actually wedged in between two noodle shops in Chinatown called Abacus Savings Bank. And this bank was charged essentially with defrauding the Fannie and Freddie in their mortgage dealings. The government didn't actually even claim any losses. They just claimed that there was fraud going on. I'm not going to get into the details of the case, but what was important about it was that this bank, I think, demonstrated the whole policy of collateral consequences indirectly, because it showed this is how small you have to be for us to go after you. We have this whole range of other targets that we could have gone after, but those companies are problematic. And here's the size of a bank that we can handle going after.
And these people are powerless. The highest paid individual who was a defendant got $90,000.
Yeah, exactly. These weren't high ranking CEOs who are pulling down $20 million. They don't have beach houses in the Hamptons or Nantucket. These are working class immigrants who've, you know, if the allegations are true, and I can't be sure of that, but we're talking about a little bit of corner cutting here and there. And And it was striking looking at the row of defendants in this courtroom and thinking, these are the people that they put on trial as representatives of what went wrong in the financial crisis. And it was just crazy. In addition to that, when they actually indicted these people, they put them all in chains for the benefit of the cameras, and they actually walked them into the courtroom in a chain gang to try to show how tough they were being on financial crime, you know, in the wake of the financial crisis. And this, again, runs completely counter to how we treated people from the really big companies.
Your fellow journalist George Packer just won the National Book Award for his book The Unwinding, which very much tells a tale of America completely losing its way. He gets very emotional about this. What scares you? Because I think you're in some of the same territory here. What scares you about this divide and where it's headed and where we're headed?
Well, I talk about this in the introduction. You know, I'm old enough to have gone to college in the Soviet Union. I spent the year, 1989, 1990, studying in Leningrad. And I remember being struck when I went there about how there were two sets of laws there. There were the official laws, and then there were the unwritten laws. And the unwritten laws were the ones that were important. Everybody had dollars. Everybody was changing dollars. Everybody was buying products in the black market, but the only ones who were getting in trouble were the ones who were like street kids who were trying to trade blue jeans on the street, whereas the director of the university could wear a Western suit to work every day and nothing would happen to him. And I realized that Soviets over a period of decades had come to internalize this system of calculations about who was prosecutable and who wasn't. And I think that we're headed towards the same kind of thing. What worries me is that it's not so much that we're not going after these big banks anymore and that we're settling for fines instead of criminal punishments. It's what's more disturbing is that the public now seems to accept that there are certain people who go to jail and then there are other people who don't go to jail. And that is a serious development that we're not talking about.
And in the Soviet Union, people accepted it until they didn't.
Right.
And boom.
It
was over.
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly what I talked about in the introduction. It was like they accepted it. And then one moment it was like they all thought about it for the first time for decades. And the outrage of it literally just blew up the entire country. And you think about what's going on in America now. We have the biggest prison population in the history of prison populations, right, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have this epidemic of white collar crime that is worsening rapidly, let's put it that way. You know, 2008, we saw certain kinds of scandals. Now, 4 or 5 years later, we're seeing anti-capitalist collusion and, you know, the Forex markets and LIBOR. These are scandals that are they're much huger in scope and in damage than we saw even just a few years ago. So this problem is getting exponentially worse, and maybe one day we all wake up and realize how unfair it is, and that could be a serious problem in this country.
Matt Taibbi is author of The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, elections in Afghanistan and India. And if this were Afghanistan or India, the results of our TV Greats bracket competition would mean holding a runoff. Tonight, the NCAA men's basketball champion will be decided, but our finalists, well, none of them got a majority of the votes, but the clear winner, the character with the 44.8% plurality.
Did I win?
It's data, folks.
The sentiment is appreciated.
The Star Trek TNG fan gang on The Takeaway has started your big comeback.
I consider you a true and valued friend.
Top TV character of all time. Can a Data movie be far behind?
Data, why are you laughing?
I do not know. It was a wonderful feeling.
Hawkeye from MASH and the listener nominee was the runner-up in our contest, 41%. Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show, a distant third with 13.6% of the vote. Thanks to all of you voters, and it seems we had a lot of fun with this, however much there is still to argue about.
I trust I did nothing unbecoming to a Starfleet officer.
Does wrestling with a Klingon Targ ring a bell?
So two other important elections are worth talking about on this Monday. Polling began in Afghanistan over the weekend, and the vastly complex election begins today in India, the world's largest democracy. We'll speak about the stakes in India in just a moment, but in Afghanistan, you might say it is democracy itself that is on the ballot. Final results will take perhaps as long as a week to tally. It appears that voter turnout was high for Afghanistan, even amidst charges of fraud and some violence. The country's election commission estimates that about 7 million votes were cast. Can Afghanistan bring more voices into the political process this time around to fight the sense that it is warlords and corruption that rules in this nation that has seen war for more than a generation? Joining us now is Sarah Chase, former special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and now senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
So it's great to talk to you again. Last time we spoke, you had just finished really a decade of work inside Afghanistan. What is the picture that's emerging in this election as you're seeing it so far?
What's interesting is it's almost as though two separate processes are unfolding simultaneously. One is the genuine enthusiasm of voters, including women voters. I was just on the phone to Kandahar before we began speaking, and friends of mine there saying that, you know, in numbers they have never seen before, the expression they used was people want to defend their vote, that there's a real enthusiasm not just to vote but to ensure that people's votes will count. And that means a lot of citizen observation. It means social media, Twittering, all of those activities to try to counter the other sort of event, which is a clear effort on the part of not just President Karzai, but other candidates to ensure their election, or in the case of President Karzai, ensure his favorite's election by way of fraudulent measures. So that's going on also. There's a lot of concern about what happens between the polling place and the final tally in Kabul, where the two institutions that are in charge of both delivering final numbers and investigating any complaints are believed to be quite subject to Karzai's influence.
So, you know, how are we to evaluate this election? I mean, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan Richard Newman suggested that the objective should not be a pristine election, but more a peaceful transfer of power that's widely accepted by Afghans to be legitimate. Doesn't that run the risk of legitimizing exactly the sort of, kind of party boss approach that the Karzai people and some of the other favorite candidates might be taking in this election right now?
Well, precisely. And even that sort of language acceptable to Afghans, you only hear that from Americans or Westerners. You don't hear that from Afghans. Afghans talk about, you know, is this honest or isn't it honest? They don't have a sort of different measure for, well, our version of honesty. Whether there was an expectation of fraud and whether people are happy about that are two very separate issues that often get confused by Western observers. And similarly, acceptable. How would we judge whether Afghans quote unquote accept an outcome that they don't go to war?
Right.
A confusing use of language.
Well, then let's judge it on the basis of new voices coming into parliament, new voices actually being part of the political process to counter some of these other notions of corruption and tribalism. What is the chance that that's going to happen here?
So I think that's a really good point. We can't begin to judge the meaning of this election until we start getting both the final results and the complaints and how those complaints are adjudicated. So I really think it's too early to judge much beyond the fact that, bless them, Afghans really, as much as they could, got engaged in this process. Now, whether that, including the new voices that you're referring to, but whether that engagement translates to real influence over the outcome and the outcome beyond just this year, but in terms of new policies and things like that, remains to be judged. The other point that I think is really important to bear in mind is journalists and others who were covering the event rarely strayed very far beyond Kabul. As I said, I was on the phone to Kandahar today, and heard from that area, which has been a kind of,
a violent zone. Journalists have been targeted, so it makes sense that they would be quiet.
Exactly. And so the point is that in some of the more dangerous parts of the country, including the midsection and the Far East, the voter turnout is likely to have been far lower than much of what we're hearing in the media.
Very quickly before we go, 23 dead on Election Day. Is that a good sign, a bad sign, or it's just part of the process?
Don't judge Taliban violence by numbers. They're really careful. Just as you mentioned, they targeted journalists. They're very careful about who they targeted. So, in fact, violence often has a greater impact than the sheer numbers might suggest. Although, again, at least where security was tighter, a lot of people did turn out to vote anyway.
Sarah Chayes is a former special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program and the South Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment. Sarah, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
The political direction of the largest country in Afghanistan's neighborhood will be determined today as the people of India go to the polls. Elections run through May 12th, polling 814 million eligible voters. Leading in the polls and considered unstoppable by many political observers in the region, Hindu nationalist candidate Narendra Modi is emerging as a new kind of politician in India. He's been the chief minister of the western state of Gujarat, which has seen tremendous prosperity and extremes of religious violence. Vinod K. Joes, executive editor of The Caravan, says the BJP party has bet its future on this regional leader whose capacity to unite India is uncertain.
This is one of the principal political parties in India, and they have put across one of their strongest candidates in history, Narendra Modi. And right now, Narendra Modi is resting his campaign on a very thin, balanced line. On the one hand, the big investors are all supporting and believing in him that probably he is going to open up the market and let foreign direct investment in retail, for example, allow, which is not the position that his party has taken. But also on the other hand, there is also this question of Indian nationalism and the past 10 years of government, while it performed really badly on corruption and development and investment issues, it did reasonably well in some of the welfare measures. So this has put money in people's pockets. Modi promises to reverse much of these schemes because in economic policy, he is more like the Republicans, if there is a comparison there.
We're talking with the Vinod K. Joes, executive editor of The Caravan, speaking to us from New Delhi, where you can really hear the sound of the unstoppable Indian economy, which will emerge strong regardless of the outcome of this election. But I'm wondering if Modi has to answer to the violence that has taken place in Gujarat, and if there are concerns in India about the future that, the kinds of casualties and targeting of Muslims that really is part of the legacy of his, regime in Gujarat is something that we will see more generally in India.
That's right. In 2002, Modi, when he took over as the chief minister of Gujarat, he presided over this violence, horrible, what many people call as even genocidal in many ways, or 1,000 Muslims got killed. And Modi never apologized for that, for his failure as an administrator. Rather, he used it in many of his political campaigns within that state. There is this fear that if he becomes the prime minister, many liberals and then people from the minority communities fear that the idea of India, it's going to get challenged in a way that the country hasn't seen, because the root cause of or the root reasoning of this ideology came from the fact that majority nationalism is the idea of India as opposed to nationalism based on social contract of religious communities, of linguistic communities, of people living in different areas, geographical differences, ethnicities, all agreeing to come together because they believe in the idea of India. That has sort of a threatening feel to many liberals on the larger question on India and India's democratic polity.
So it's possible that the success of Narendra Modi would herald the potential that India for the next 10 years could really just be a very fractured state of ethnicities and regional groups. Would you say that this election and the future in this century suggests that the Gandhi national idea of India is really a dead idea right now?
It has definitely taken a big beating. We really don't know whether there is a reverse course of Gandhi kind of an idea of India. And there is a genuine crisis also of lack of leadership. And in that sense, this election is very crucial.
Commenting on the Indian elections, Vinod K. Jose is executive editor of The Caravan, speaking to us from New Delhi. Thanks so much, Vinod.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This week, the Retro Report documentary team looks back at an approach to fighting urban crime that changed the definition of childhood in the midst of gang violence in the late 90s.
In Chicago, the body of an 11-year-old gang member nicknamed Yummy is found beneath an underpass.
Police say Robert was murdered by two members of his own gang, 16-year-old Craig Hardaway and his younger brother.
The 1994 murder of Robert Sandifer signaled to law and order politicians in Congress that treating juvenile offenders differently than adults amounted to surrendering to violent criminals. Here's 1996 presidential candidate Bob Dole and Georgia Congressman Newt Gingrich.
Kids that once stole hubcaps, now rape and murder. No fear of punishment. Experts call them super predators.
There are no violent offenses that are juvenile. You rape somebody, you're an adult. You shoot somebody, you're an adult.
Bonnie Bertram, as Retro Report producer, says aggressive prosecution of juveniles by declaring them adults, whatever their age, had implications for prosecutors, judges, and the prison system. Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Nice to see you.
So where did that idea of super predators come from, and how important was the Robert Sandifer murder?
Well, John DiIulio was a professor at Princeton. He was a political science professor, but he'd done a lot of work studying the criminal justice system, and he'd been in prisons. And he was looking at some studies from some of his colleagues who showed that there was going to be a massive influx of teenagers in the coming years and that there are going to be even more numbers of violent teens than before. And he really wasn't content to just say, wow, this is coming, let's all sit here and observe it. He really wanted to sort of sound an alarm and let people know that he thought things were going to get a lot worse.
And back in the 90s, he was very much on the TV circuit making this point.
We're talking about a group of kids who are growing up essentially fatherless, godless, and jobless.
And his academic approach to this crime problem became a political opportunity for American politicians on the Law and Order platform.
Well, it started when he wrote an article for the then new Weekly Standard magazine that was fairly conservative. And he said that he was quoting a prisoner when he went to visit a prison who said, these kids, they're stone-cold predators. And from that, he coined the phrase super predator, and it became the headline of the piece, and then it just took off.
And what happened in terms of prosecutions, in terms of an approach to crime, and in terms of actual defendants, people who were prosecuted as adults?
Well, I mean, you have to remember at the time, 1994 was a pretty terrible summer in Chicago, especially not just Robert Sandifer, but there was another Eric Morse story where a kid was dangled out the 14th floor window and dropped from an apartment building and killed because he wouldn't sell candy for some other boys. So I think the whole country was feeling this sense of sort of crime fatigue and weariness. And so John DiIulio and a bunch of other people looked at these numbers and said, wow, this could really be a bad thing. So after this peak of juvenile violence had been going up, you know, for 10 years and was expected to go up even more, they decided that they needed to crack down on criminals. And, you know, part of that Bob Dole bite, if you listen to it more, he says, you know, it was a revolving door of criminal justice for these kids.
And looking back now from 2014, really, you get a sense that particularly DiIulio has some regrets about all this. Let's listen to what he said to you in an interview for the Retro Report.
We were at the, you know, on the precipice of being able to explain and predict all kinds of things, poverty trends, crime trends, and so forth. None of that work, none of those predictions in any of those fields have borne fruit. The super predator idea was wrong. Once it was out there, though, it was out there. There was no reeling it in.
The story really of how science can delude you into thinking that you have control and can actually make policy that's going to fix things overnight.
And data and numbers. And he says demography is not fate and criminology is not pure science.
And in terms of where this fits today, have we reversed course? Is the idea of juvenile justice an appropriate way of dealing with young violent offenders? Or do we still have echoes from that time where if you're violent enough, you're going to get the book thrown at you, even as an 11-year-old.
Well, the super predator notion permeated all kinds of ways people looked at juvenile sentencing and juvenile justice. And in 2005 and then again in 2012, the Supreme Court has reevaluated its stance on juvenile sentencing laws, and they've tried to make things a little bit more relaxed. But what happens is these things are implemented on the state level. So the Supreme Court can say something, but it's really up to the states to implement it.
Bonnie Bertram is a Retro Report producer. To see a video of the Retro Report's findings on super predators, visit thetakeaway.org. Bonnie, thanks so much.
Sure.
A ping has been detected in the month-long search for Malaysia Flight 370 at about 1,000 miles northwest of Perth, Australia.
I need to be honest with you. It could take some days before the information is available to establish whether these detections can be confirmed as being from MH370.
That's the cautious chief of the Australian search operation, Angus Houston, speaking today. A number of search vessels are in the area or on the way, racing with the batteries on the flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorders from that Boeing 777. It's believed that they are nearly out of power. So how to separate a ping from all of the other noises at the bottom of the Indian Ocean? Dave Gallo knows a lot about the bottom of the sea. He's the director of special projects at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dave, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, John.
So what's the challenge here? And is a ping a ping a ping, period, the end?
Well, no, a ping is not a ping because this one, this particular ping is at a certain frequency, 37.5 kilohertz, and it's at a certain rep rate about once a second. So, and in some cases, they've heard two of them, which is ideal because one should be associated with the pingers on the black, on the black box being the cockpit voice recorder and then the flight data recorder.
And in this case, you believe this is a pretty positive development.
I'm really, for the first time in the past month, encouraged that I think this is a very solid lead that may well prove to be incredibly fruitful to finding the aircraft.
Now, convince me, because I've been following this story for a month now, and, you know, there have been so many false leads, and, you know, I'm not, I don't even have a stake in this. I mean, I can only imagine from the perspective of families and victims and people who are following every detail. Yeah. Convince me that this might be the real deal.
Here's what I can say. The ship, the Ocean Shield, that detected the pings has on board the team from Phoenix International working with the U.S. Navy, and they are about as good as it comes to doing this kind of work. So when they hear something, they are very careful before they call it a target that's important. So just the fact that they found it, they listened to it twice, has a lot of credibility in my mind.
All right, technologically speaking, what is the challenge of going from a ping to fixing an actual location, getting an image, and then getting down there with a submersible?
Well, already we've reduced the size of the possible haystack down to something manageable. So that's step number one, if this pans out to be what they really think are the black boxes. So the next step is they'll try to triangulate on that and get an actual position on the seafloor. So they know where the surface ship was, but the water depth there is on the order of, depending on where you are, 1, 2, or 3 miles. So they need to find that spot on the seafloor. The next step is to actually get a vehicle with side-scan sonar or cameras down to that spot and start doing a survey of the seafloor to try to find a debris field on the seafloor itself.
And once we do that, is there, I mean, there couldn't possibly be a rescue operation. There's only a recovery operation. What's the challenge there?
Well, the big challenge is, of course, every time we go into the deep ocean, and this would characterize as deep even to academic researchers, it's difficult to work. There's nothing routine about it. So just running that survey at these depths is going to be tricky. And then picking out an aircraft against the backdrop of steep slopes and maybe volcanic terrain is not going to be easy either. So this is by no means a cakewalk from here. It's going to take a lot of work, and That could be weeks just there, just trying to get a vehicle together with the right tools to get down there and make those maps.
What are the maps like? What is the knowledge base of that part of the Indian Ocean? It's not terribly well traveled, and it's certainly not the you know, the most known part of the undersea world.
Not at all. And you've heard me say many times before, we've only explored about 7% of the world beneath the sea. Well, this part has hardly had any kind of serious exploration. And it looks to me that they're on the north side of a underwater mountain that may be about, in places, a mile or two rising above the seafloor. That could be good. It could be bad. You know, we're just looking at very general maps, so I won't know till they get in there and make the first couple of sweeps of the area with their mapping tools. So we don't know what to expect. You know, that's the thing about mapping the bottom of the sea. You can't just go to Google Maps and pull up your deep sea map of mountain ranges, and that's what's needed here is a base map so they can start to plan the further operations on it.
How much of a partnership is there between the scientific community, which has its own interests in knowing how to detect and see what's on the bottom of the ocean, and this sort of rescue and military infrastructure that's mobilized whenever a plane goes into the water?
Yeah, I think there's a good deal of cooperation. I mean, we go to the deep sea routinely in the world that I live in, the academic research world, along with many other organizations around the planet. So, you know, the idea, and in the waters above, the idea that, well, look at all the trash out here, well, look at all the big waves, or look at all the rough, you know, welcome to oceanography. So I was, this is something that we are completely familiar with. The Navy is not always that concerned with the deep ocean, so in some cases we can actually help them understand how to work the deep sea floor, especially when it comes to understanding volcanic terrain. Because remember, the trick here is to be able to pick a debris field or an aircraft out against a backdrop of very steep slopes and rugged underwater terrain. It's not just, hey, there's the plane. This is all done initially with sonar, with shadow. So you have to have a good operator and the right equipment to do this.
The challenge going forward as the search for Malaysian Flight 370 appears to be narrowed to a location about 1,000 miles from Perth, Australia. Dave Gallo, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Dave Gallo is the Director of Special Projects at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. On this day, April 7th, 20 years ago, the genocide in Rwanda began.
We still find bones, not as much as we used to, and the government and the community has done a really good job trying to recover bones and have them laid to rest in one of the many, many memorial sites around the country.
This week, Voices from the Genocide and Rwanda's Rebuilding. Coming up, more from public health entrepreneur and Professor Jox Ruxin, who is helping to turn Rwanda's persistent grief into durable hope about the future. A conversation about hope and a restaurant called Heaven. It did not sound like this 20 years ago today in Kigali, Rwanda, when that nation's tragic genocide began. The sounds you're hearing there from the more joyful remembrances taking place today of the Rwandan genocide that killed at least 800,000 people and, by some accounts, well over a million. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power is representing the United States. 20 years ago, she was one of the journalists who helped bring the killing in Rwanda to the attention of the world. Another American observing this nation's grief and hope is humanitarian, public health entrepreneur, and local businessman in Kigali, Jox Ruxin. Ruxin is a professor at Columbia University's Mailman Center for Public Health. His book, A Thousand Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and a Restaurant in Rwanda, tells the story of how he and his wife, Alyssa, went to Rwanda to open a restaurant and help the country rebuild. It was an adventure that taught them a lot about Rwanda, about the limits of aid and philanthropy, and it taught them a lot about themselves.
I think that probably the greatest stress on the marriage has always been life in Rwanda from a lot of different perspectives. We are part of a much bigger family than just ourselves, than just our three kids who are now nearly 7, 5, and 2 and don't really know any other places home than Rwanda. And really, Heaven Restaurant was our first child in some sense. We feel stress that comes from dealing with the grind of daily poverty and how that impacts the people around us who we love, who we care about, and with whom we work.
What's it like to get a knock at the door and some very lovely ladies are explaining that you have a surprise in your garden?
Yeah, soon after we moved into the home that is still our home in Kigali, we were informed that there was a body buried in our backyard, a young man who had been murdered during the height of the genocide. We, of course, welcomed them into our home, and a couple of weeks later, they came through and dug up the body, which you would have thought would have been an incredibly somber event. But as it turned out for that family, knowing where their kin was buried, knowing that he was there, and knowing that they could give him a proper burial made it a celebration instead of the most somber of affairs. But certainly the genocide still does play into our daily life one way or another.
And you still find bones?
We still find bones, not as much as we used to. And the government and the community has done a really good job trying to recover bones and have them laid to rest in one of the many, many memorial sites around the country.
With all of the problems in Rwanda, and you see the effects of the amputations and people walking around Kigali even today, what is the source of the empowerment that allows you and your programs and the team that you work with to make progress on something as intractable as systemic poverty?
Well, one of the things that we've really got in our favor is that nearly half of the entire Rwandan population at this point was born after the genocide. So the memories of the genocide, while being part of this national dialogue, of course it's there and it's on people's minds, has faded into the past to some degree, and everyone is quite a bit more focused on the future, on getting jobs, on getting education, on the sorts of normal daily challenges that people all over the world face. But I've spent a lot of time talking with young people in Kigali today and asking them, how is it possible that you can work with people whose parents literally were responsible for the deaths of your parents? And they say, we just don't have time. We don't have time to think about the hatred and to dwell on it. We've got too many other responsibilities. We've got a job by day. We're studying in university by night. There's just not enough time.
How do they think of you in Rwanda? Are you some kind of doctor? Are you some kind of minister? Are you just the crazy chef who puts ginger in everything?
I think we are the crazy Americans who, against all odds, have decided to spend the last decade living in Rwanda. Not crazy in the sense that we think that there's anything crazy about it, because we love Rwanda. We love the people. We love the climate. We love the quality of life. It's safe. Our kids can run around the streets at all hours, and we don't have to worry about them. Not crazy in that sense. Crazy in the sense that lots of Rwandans look at us and say, why would you give up New York City to be here? And for us, our answer is that we really fell in love with Rwanda, and that's where our lives are.
Tell me a story of when you got it about the frustrations and the puzzles that you couldn't figure out in the beginning, and you suddenly, oh, here's how to do it.
Well, it's been a slow-growing process for me, because as an academic originally, someone who studied development, of course I thought that I had the answers when I first got there on the ground. But over time, I really learned from the locals, and I learned from my country directors. There's a guy named Blaise who headed up Health Builders for quite a few years. And it was Blaise who really explained to me that doing great public health work wasn't about working in the capital. It was about working in the field and in the health centers where most people get treated. Although my inclination was, let's save who we can, let's work on this clinically, he said, don't be a doctor. Don't be a traditional public health worker. Let's go in like managers. Let's make sure that they've got QuickBooks for their accounting. Let's make sure that the nurses are getting paid on time. And those approaches in our public health work have paid off in spades in terms of the health outcomes people care about, in terms of child's lives saved and mother's lives saved. But it's not sexy to go in and say, hey, we're supporting accounting. We're supporting human resources. We're making sure that they've got a good financial plan. And that's something I learned from him.
And what about the restaurant? What's the favorite dish?
Well, I've got so many favorites, but we've got a wonderful new chef from San Francisco who just started up a couple weeks ago. She made a fantastic filet mignon with a carrot puree and some caramelized onions on top that I had the other evening. That was one of the best pieces of meat that I've ever had. And of course, it's very, very free range.
So solve poverty in Rwanda and be sure to serve filet mignon.
I think that you can go a long way towards solving poverty by creating the sorts of jobs that we're creating. Our servers are some of the best paid in the entire country, and every one of them has got either a university degree or they're working on a university degree. They're supporting siblings. They're still supporting orphans of the genocide, but without ever receiving some check from a charity.
Somebody told you one time that if you live close to the cemetery, you can't cry. Who was that person, and what were they trying to tell you?
It's actually a fairly common saying in Rwanda, as you can imagine, in light of the genocide and in light of the fact that literally the whole country is a form of a graveyard and a cemetery. The person I remember best who told me that was Abed, who's been our driver for many, many years. I think his point is that if you try to appreciate and feel the very burden of the genocide all the time, that it's very hard to move on, and that today we shed our tears for the tragedies that continue. And there are many. And they are manifold. But for us, I think we look at that past and we're inspired. And we take a look at Rwanda today, 20 years out, and think, here's a country that everyone said was going to fail, and it's succeeding. And we have this unbelievable opportunity to be part of making a contribution to the future. So we feel lucky as can be.
Josh Ruxin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Josh Ruxin is a professor at Columbia University's Mailman Center for Public Health, author of 1,000 Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and A Restaurant in Rwanda. Tomorrow we'll hear from one of the survivors from the killings 20 years ago, Eugenie Mukeshimana. Today she runs the Genocide Survivors Support Network here in the U.S., which strives to give immigrant genocide survivors the legal and social help they need to rebuild their lives. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.